The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Roy Blunt's new book is as much fun to read backwards as forwards. This is a book for people who urgently, passionately love words. Even its title is fun to say. Alphabet juice, the energies, gists, and spirits of letters, words, and combinations thereof, their roots, bones, innards, pithes, pips, and secret parts, tinctures, tonics, essences, with examples of their usage, foul and savory. Many of you probably know Roy Blunt as a panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, or as a guest on A Prairie Home Companion. But you may have encountered his work in the Atlantic Monthly, where he writes a regular column, or you may have seen his essays, articles, stories, and verse in over 166 periodicals, including The New Yorker, Playboy, or Rolling Stone. He's a prolific man. He's the author of 21 books about a wide range of things, from the first woman president of the United States to what barnyard animals are thinking. His previous book, Long Time Leaving, Dispatches from Up South, won the 2007 Nonfiction Award from the New England Independent Bookseller Association. And speaking of books, his book will be for sale tonight by another great independent store, our very own library store, and he will be signing afterwards. Or perhaps you encountered Mr. Blunt while jumping out of an airplane, or scuba diving with sharks, or catching catfish in Illinois, or rafting the Amazon, or playing baseball with the 1969 Chicago Cubs. Wherever you may have encountered Mr. Blunt, you will have found a supremely funny and entertaining man who is eloquent on the joys of language. Please welcome Roy Blunt, Jr. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Now I'm going to start this off by breaking the podium. I hope not, but there's a way to make it go up. Up? Isn't that cool? Am I instantly audible to everyone? There's no delay or anything? I have always been interested in words, and as long as I can remember, I've been taking notes. I actually have notebooks that go back to high school in which I wrote down little things about new words I was learning and ways people were using words wrong. I already felt qualified to determine that. And so I always wanted to write a book about words, but I never quite knew, you know, what kind of angle to take. It seemed like you had to have some kind of gimmick to write a book about words. And but I was reading one day a textbook of linguistics in which it was stated that the relation between words and their meaning is arbitrary. A fuller statement of that is in a book called The First Word, which is this: a word is an arbitrary association between sound and meaning. There is nothing in the sound of a word that tells you what it means or what it does. You must learn this as a child. I don't know whether that means you must learn what words mean as a child, or you must learn what I just told you as a child. Marshall McLuhan said, letters are semantically meaningless, referred to semantically meaningless letters made to correspond to semantically meaningless sounds. That just didn't ring true to me, never has. It may be that I'm obsessed with this, in part because I was not breastfed. I'm not being judgmental or anything, but in fact, it was pointed out to me by my mother that I had not been breastfed. I had been sacrificed for in many other ways, but somehow I was not breastfed. But she did teach me to read at a very early age before I went off to school, and she taught me phonetically, sound out the words, she would say. Now, as we all know, phonetics in English phonetic values in English are not very consistent, and it's a tricky thing to decide what a word means by sounding it out. But I defy linguisticians to prove to me that that the sound of words and other aspects of words, which I will get into in a moment, have nothing to do with the meaning. The word, getting back to breastfeeding, the word mammal comes from the word mammary gland, which is a distinguishing mark of mammals. And according to every dictionary you will look at, the word mammary comes from baby talk, comes from mama. So, and not only that, of course, but the word mater comes from the Latin for mother, mater. And so not only what kind of animal we are, but also the very physical substance of things, our words for those come from baby talk. And also the Matrix, of course, so the big hit movie also comes from baby talk. And it seems to me that babies don't start out saying, you know, actually babies tend to say da-da or papa before they say mama. But, and I guess they say da-da or papa again because it makes the old man light up so much. But I don't think they know what it means otherwise. But babies, I think there is a connection between nursing and mama. After all, the lips are pressed together, and when you pronounce an M, and their lips are pressed together, and you make an M sound when you're saying mmm or yum or I even wonder whether the word me doesn't come from that. But at any rate, almost every language, the great majority of languages, spell the word for mother either beginning with the letter M or a vowel followed by M. The M sound begins the word for mother in this vast majority of languages. But, of course, that could just be coincidental. Could be that we have to teach babies to say mama. I don't believe that, but it could be. But it seems to me there are lots of other words that whose sound, and as I say, another quality of words, have something to do with meaning. This is a little bit indelicate, but I know you people can deal with bodily functions. I was reading a book about language, and it mentioned that the Latin word for to urinate, educated literary term for to urinate in ancient Rome was urinari. However, the common vernacular people's word, street word for to urinate was, I will spell this out for you, P-I-S-S-E-R-E, because it's on television. I don't know whether you can say pissery on television or not. But then in this book, the author said, obviously, urinari is this sort of an abstract term for urination, whereas pissere is echoic of the act of urination. And I was saying, yes, exactly. The people's words bubble up from the body. And meanwhile, all these scholars are always trying to rarefy and abstractify everything. Yeah, piss. But then it occurred to me that P-I-S-S does not sound like the act of urination unless you're doing it on a hot rock. However, there is something about that word that evokes urination. And it occurred to me that that's because it starts out with P, lips pressed together, a contained letter, P, and then it flows out, isri, pissri. When that occurred to me, all sorts of linguistic values started leaping to the fore. For instance, bear in mind that that word, the English version of that word is sip backwards. Works the same way either way. Start out sip. There are lots of other words, common words. I mean, there are plenty of words which are, not onomatopoeic, but words like persnickety and rickety and wallow and elbow. I mean, well, elbow, that's stretching a little far, but wobble and, queasy. And if you were a cave person who had no, verbal tradition at all, there were no words in your community at all, you might well come up with the word for, if you felt bad enough in your stomach, you might well come up with the word nausea. That does not seem to me arbitrary at all. Even the word arbitrary comes from the Latin arbiter, who's, you know, like a baseball umpire, somebody who comes to judge a dispute, arbiter. And the word arbiter comes from the Latin ad, meaning to, and biteri, meaning to come or to go. An arbiter was somebody who came somewhere to settle a dispute. So if you spoke Latin, arbiter was a lot like go-to guy or, gopher, as in somebody who goes for something. So that doesn't seem arbitrary to me at all. It's not onomatopoeic, but it is recognizable chunks of simple words joined together to form a more complicated word. But then there are words, common words like through. Lots of people don't like to think too much about what goes on in their mouths. But if you follow the word through your mouth, you know, involving your tongue, which, as Robert Benchley said, the tongue is that awful-looking thing right back of your teeth. You may not want to think about it too much, but if you follow your tongue through your mouth when you're saying the word through, it starts out the front and goes right back, and then there's a little puff of smoke that comes out in the form of an H, through. Whereas the word thwart starts out TH, but then that W jumps up there. As it's going back, the W jumps up, and the next thing you know, you're saying wart, which is... And the word throttle starts out like through, but then it suddenly goes back into the back of your throat in your glottis, back there, where you do your glottal stops, as in words like uh-oh and no you didn't and I'm getting married in the morning. So throttle seems to me, it's not onomatopoeic, but it's kinesthetic in some way. It reproduces, not exactly, but it... You can't tell me that when people were trying to figure out a word for the concept throttle, they weren't guided to some extent by the way it works in your mouth. The word throb is another one of those THR words that, throb, boom, boom, boom. It seems to me that sort of thing is worth considering when you're using language. I've always been interested in language and how people produce it. And it seems to me that it's worthwhile to retain any inherent language in anything anymore. Money, for instance. You may have noticed in recent weeks that a whole lot of money, because it was too abstractly derived, has just disappeared, gone off into smoke. It's always good to try to get things back to the body. All English is body English at some point. You can certainly think of words that are too abstract to have any real sonic value, but why would you want to? It's sort of like food. It's happened to food, too, that people have over-rarefied food. For instance, there's a man at the University of Georgia Poultry Science Department. Whenever I think of poultry scientists, I think of people following chickens around. But chicken is a wonderful word, by the way. It's got a K in it. I've always liked the letter K because you use the letter K, for instance. Well, in the Sunshine Boys, Walter Matthau says that the movie about two old comedians, they've got this gig to do a commercial for a cereal called Frumpies. And Walter Matthau refuses to do a commercial for Frumpies because Frumpies is not funny. He said funny words have a K in them. Chicken, for instance. But the K is like when you're urging a horse to go forward or you're sort of sonically winking at someone, indicating to someone that she is appealing to you. You go, and you may call that arbitrary. I think it makes its way into words. And words that have K's in them, therefore, they click in a way that words that don't have K's in them do. But I've always just been interested in words, and there are a lot of just stories in here about how words are used. There was I was out to make a speech in somewhere out in the middle of Pennsylvania one time, and I was picked up at the airport by a driver who, as we were driving along, said, you know, we're passing very near to Gettysburg right now. And I thought, I don't think Gettysburg is near here. And he said, and you know, we complained today, but those guys at Gettysburg were out in the snow all winter, had no shoes, just wrapped rags around their feet. And I said, oh, he's got it confused with Valley Forge. So I understand now. We were driving along a little further, and there was a sign in the yard that said, Marge's Fine Pies. And I said, oh, well, that lady sells pie out of her house there. I'd take it. And the guy said, oh, yeah. Oh, you talk about some pies. She sells pies that are lemon meringue pies that are big as a chef's hat. I thought that was impressive. He said, in fact, the meringue on them are that thick. And I thought, that's not very thick, it seems to me, for the meringue of a hat that can be compared to a toque. So I was wondering, and then we drove along a little further, and he said, you know, it was Valentine's last week, and I made my wife a Valentine out of cardboard, made a big heart out of cardboard, and ran an arrow, made an arrow out of wire, and I ran that heart right through the middle of that arrow. And I thought, that's sort of an odd way of putting it, somehow or another. But I guess you could put it that way. And then he said, oh, yeah, my wife, she's smarter than I am. We went to high school together, and she was a hoo-hoo. And I said, what's a hoo-hoo? And he said, you know, they put out that book every year, Hoo-Hoos in American High School. I had never met a man before who was dyslexic to the extent of pie. You know? But there was. And speak of pie, another aspect of language, another very physical, loud aspect of language is Proto-Indo-European roots. There's, in the back, I'm a usage consultant to the American Heritage Dictionary, and in the back of the American Heritage Dictionary is a whole appendix of Proto-Indo-European roots. You'll be reading along. Here, I'll give you an example. Say you're looking up pedigree, for instance. You'll be directed to go to the index and see the root G-E-R-E. Gary, I guess. Or Jerry. I don't know how you pronounce it. And you go back there and you find that the root Jerry has produced the words crack, grackle, pedigree, cranberry, and geranium. Then there's the root weg, W-E-G-H, from which we get vogue, weight, as in W-E-I-G-H-T, wiggle, weigh, and earwig. Then there's pag, P-I-G, from which we get fang, newfangled, peace, pact, palisade, travel, peel, pole, pagan, peasant, propagate, pectin, compact, impinge, pace, and pageant. I'm sorry if to go on and on, but it just gives me chills to realize. And what PIE, Proto-Indo-European roots are things that we have, that linguists have figured out beginning back in 1780 when an English judge in India noticed that there were so many similarities between roots, between words in Sanskrit, Greek and Latin, that they must have come from a common language, original source language. And over the centuries, linguists have worked it out to the point where we now can be sure that a third of the world's peoples, all the Romantic speakers of Romantic Romance languages or Germanic languages or many other languages, speak languages that derive from Proto-Indo-European, a language which died. It's completely no, there were no traces, and in fact, that whole culture left no traces. But linguists were able to reconstruct that culture to a certain extent. Nobody knows where it lived. There are some clues based on how many words there are for river and how few for sand or something that give us a sense that they live somewhere in some areas of Europe. But there are no traces of those people left. But that their language gave birth to so many other languages that I say a third of the world's people speak those languages. And if you go back there into the appendix, you just can hear all those languages groaning to be born. Wag and woof and grub. And that just, I love that. The Proto-Indo-European languages, they're all here. I'll read you another example of Proto-Indo-European. Meanwhile, I'll tell you about the word Google. The word Google, the story of the word Google is that the original Google word was coined by Milton Serrata in 1938. And Milton Serrata was 9 years old at the time. Milton Serrata was out on a walk with his uncle, Edward Kasner, who's a distinguished American mathematician. And Uncle Ed said to Milton, "Give me a word for the biggest possible number." Now, lots of children would say something like bazillions, quadrillion, begillion, yillion, or something. But Milton was better than that. Milton said, with simple dignity, "Google." He may have been influenced by Barney Google, the comic strip, but we don't know for sure. But that's what he said, and he left it at that. And his uncle decided to spell it G-O-O, not like Barney Google, but G-O-O-G-O-L, which has a sort of more, it seems a little more mathematical, for instance, for one thing. Google is sort of like mogul or mongol or something. And was spelled that way. Of course, his Uncle Ed was not content. Somebody's always, it's like when you're a kid, you know, you say, I'm a billion times better than you are, and they'll say, I'm a squillion times better than you are. Uncle Ed decided to come up with Googleplex, which is Google to the Googleth power. But then when those young men in Mountain View, California, invented the search engine company Google, they have admitted that they didn't realize that Google, the original Google, was spelled the way it is, so they spell their company G-O-O-G-L-E. And their Googleplex, if you've ever been there, is their headquarters in Mountain View, and it looks like Berkeley in the 60s without any faculty. It's just sort of a form of heaven. By company policy, nobody is more than 100 feet from free food of all sorts. And there's a volleyball court, and you could just live there forever if you were into mathematics, I guess. So that's what a Googleplex is now. But it's good to remember where Google came from, and it also is, I found it interesting to sort of push Google back toward the body, which you can. I don't know whether we can't read Milton's mind, Milton Serrata, but it could be that he was thinking somehow or another, distantly, of the word Google as it's used in the Smoky Mountains. There's a wonderful book called The Dictionary of Smoky Mountain English, which defines Google, or Goozle, as the throat, Adam's apple. In 1859, a resident of the Smokies was said to have relished a meal of turnip greens cooked with hog's Google. The Adam's apple, larger than Eve's, hence deeper in pitch, is the voice box, which in infants googles out goo-goo noises. Has Google rounded up a Google of data bits yet? Depends on when you read this. Well, what if this one was to be the Googleth one? Wait a minute. Has anybody gotten credit for Googleth? Which now, as I think about it, I'm no Milton Serrata. But, and also I found Google, the present participle of the verb Google, in Huckleberry Finn. The Duke is pretending to be mute, and so Huck says, the Duke, he never let on he suspicioned what was up, but just went a-goo-gooing around, happy and satisfied, like a jug that's googling out buttermilk. I think we can imagine a jug going glug, 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 and when we go glug, 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 our Adam apple bobbles a little bit. You may find that a stretch to go from the largest number in the world to the Adam's apple, but I find it comforting. There's also, for a century or so, it was considered almost illegal in academia to reflect upon the origins of language. Because how can you prove it? Way back there's no way of proving, And under the influence of Noam Chomsky in recent years, the whole focus of linguistics has been on establishing the fact that there is a universal hardwired human grammar, which is more interesting, I would think, to computer programmers than to people who use words for a living. There's always a distinction between descriptive and prescriptive lexicography. And prescriptive is out of fashion. Because who can tell anybody how to say things anymore? I have no license to prescribe anything. However, as somebody who's been dealing in words for the last 40 years professionally, I think that I do have a certain franchise, which is over the counter. And I can, if I'm going to be dealing out aspirin, I have to know that those aspirin are good aspirin. And so there are lots of ways to complain about the way people use language, but people love to complain about how other people use words. People have pet peeves. Peeve or peevish is a wonderful word, it seems to me. It takes a while to say it, peevish. It's a sort of persnickety sort of word. And I try not to dwell too much on my peeves, but I do have certain ones, and I can justify those peeves, I believe, by the way they depart from phoneticism, from the body. For instance, this thing right here, a mic, a microphone, or if you're familiar with it enough, you can call it a mic. There's nothing wrong with that. But these days, people, sound technicians, and almost everybody spells the word mic, M-I-C. That is not the way the word mic ought to be spelled. Not the way the word mic has been spelled for years, but suddenly there it is, M-I-C. M-I-C spells mic. Would you spell bike as in bicycle, B-I-C? No, that's bic. Bike is B-I-K-E. Tricycle is T-R-I-K-E. There's little enough phoneticism in English, and we shouldn't just throw it away just as lightly as a good solid word. And a good sound, a word that's all about sound, a microphone, ought to be spelled phonetically if we can, and we can, so we should. just bothers me. You know, we don't spell the word fridge, F-R-I-G, because it looks like rhymes with pig. Also, other problems with that. But we spell fridge, F-R-I-D-G-E, because it looks like it sounds, fridge. So those are some of my peeves. And there are other peeves, however, that I'm realistic enough to give up on, like the expression, beg the question. Beg the question means, traditionally, to beg the question is to assert what is to be proven. If you say, have you stopped beating your wife? It's a loaded question. It's a question that's being begged. But these days, people on TV and people in the major newspapers and respectable publications use beg the question to mean, the fact that nobody has any money anymore begs the question of where it went. Which is to say, it prompts the question, or it raises the question, or it, emphatically moves us to ask the question, which is just not what that expression originally meant. And it's a shame to lose the original meaning. But the problem is that if you go on television and you use it right, which is to say the old traditional meaning, people won't know what you're saying. And so, if you can do it among people, if you can check the audience and say, make it clear to everybody that we all know what beg the question means, and we're using it in the sense that our grandfathers used it and it was good enough for them. But we don't have that audience. We probably do here, but we don't have it generally. So we might as well just, but on the other hand, I don't want to use it in the new way either. So I just have to come up with some new way of putting that. I do believe that every time somebody uses the word disinterested to mean uninterested, an angel dies. But I'm not telling you what to do. I'm just saying that literate people lose a little bit of hope every time it happens. I've already found fault to find with the president-elect. I hate to say this because I admire the president-elect. I was moved when he was elected, and I look forward to him changing the tenor of the country, which would that alone would not be too hard. But I'm very enthusiastic. I voted for him as hard as I could. And in fact, I'm on this radio show, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and we had Barack Obama on there as a not-my-job guest, a celebrity guest. And he was saying that when he first showed up at the Senate, he was astonished to find that every senator had a desk, and a wooden desk, and other senators over the centuries have carved their names into the desks. And I said, are you supposed to do that? And he said, well, I thought as the only African-American member of the Senate, I would spray paint my name on my desk. Okay. I decided if I had not been going to vote for him before, I was certainly going to after that. But the president-elect says he has said this. He said, the president has invited Michelle and I to come visit. I guess it sounds more presidential. I don't know, more elegant. It's Michelle and me. What's wrong with the word me? You know, it's not just presidents. I once heard Whitey Ford. Remember Whitey Ford used to play for the Yankees? He said, Mickey and me got into some bad ice cubes last night, but which is okay. I mean, Mickey and me got into bad ice cubes. That's supposed to be Mickey and I. But when you say that they served Mickey and I some bad ice cubes, which is what he said, I thought, oh, man, Whitey Ford is cooler than that. Mickey and him. If I knew Mickey Mantle, I wouldn't go around saying Mickey and I. In the objective case, I would say, don't serve Mickey and me the wrong things. At any rate, and also Obama has said, the president and myself will be discussing so-and-so. Yeah. I don't know how we get the word to him, but if everybody here just drops him a little note and my wife and I feel that you should refer to your people and you, yourself, as, I don't know, it gets a little tangled. But people, it's a shame when a simple word like me and a simple word like I, you know how where the word I came from in English? You wonder, it's the only first person singular, so far as I know, I believe this to be the case, that is capitalized. Is that a matter of egotism on the part of British and American imperial sorts? No, probably not. Maybe in part, but the story of how I became the first person singular became capital I is a long, complicated one. It's originally in English, the first person singular was ich, sort of like ich in German. It was ich, and that's not a great, you don't want to say if you're getting married. Will you take this woman to be your lawfully wedded wife? You don't want to say ich do. It just doesn't sound very good. Then it became itch. It was a while, it was actually itch. And you don't somehow, the 7-year itch is bad enough, but the wedding day itch is itch do. It doesn't sound too very good. Then the ch got transferred over to the verb in some cases. People would say instead of itch will, they would say chill. So there's another bad response to will you take this woman to be your lawfully, or will you do promise to beg, however it goes, honor and obey, love, honor and obey. If you say chill, that's not so great either. At any rate, gradually the first person singular boiled down to I, a small letter I, uncapitalized I, which originally did not have a dot on it. So, and I, that was just a little strike called a minim. You call that a little, in when scribes were writing words, for instance, the word tongue used to be T-U-N-G. Nobody seems to know how the U-E got on there. But at any rate, tongue was spelled phonetically, T-U-N-G. But U and N were both sort of just, you know, short little letters, short little, you know, two little minims, two little short strokes, and those four short strokes sort of swum together, so the scribes decided to change it to O, N, so you could separate the O from the N. And so when the first person singular was just one little short stroke like that, it got mixed in with M's and W's and N's, and so they put a dot over it, but that still didn't really distinguish it enough, because dots tend to wander away. And so they capitalized it. So that's how that's how I am capitalized now. I are capitalized. I is capitalized. That's how I is capitalized now. So there are lots. Obviously, the English language evolves and changes, and we have to be prepared to let it evolve and change. It's not as if we can stand in its way, but we can use it as. You know, we can use it as well as we can. And one aspect of using in language as well as we can, I think, is to bear in mind the sonic and kinesthetic values of words. As I was saying about half an hour ago, for a long time it was considered academically unrespectable to speculate on the origins of language. But lately people have been doing it. There's a really interesting book by Stephen Mithin called The Singing Neanderthal, which postulates that language began, he's got an acronym, HMMMM, which is holistic, manipulative, multimodal, musical, and mimetic. And he suggests that if you didn't have any words and you were trying to get somebody to go hunting eagles, well, you wouldn't hunt eagles, would you? Hunting birds with you of some sort, you would act out the acts of hunting, and you would imitate the song of birds, and you would manipulate. You would be using your fingers, or maybe pulling at the person. It's like me when I was in Japan once. I could not connect to that language at all, so I was just sort of using everything I had other than words. Surely that's how language began. And gradually it got, people began to figure out words, not just arbitrarily, it seems to me, but in connection with with sound and with the way words move through your mouth. I've heard the poet David Wagoner lecture once about language, and he referred to the word roar. He said the word roar, that's obviously onomatopoeic, but roar, he said, is obviously a word from back before there were words. And I love the idea of words like that. But there are all sorts of words that, for instance, the word thee, which I don't know how you can justify the word thee as a product of the body exactly, but there's lately been a development in the word thee. From texting and typing online generally, you will notice, for some reason, I don't know whether, I've been trying to figure this out, but it is true that frequently when I'm writing thee, I instead write te, T-E-H. This apparently happens to everybody. And people, you know, texting, it's too much of a, people are in too much of a hurry or something to change anything. So the word te has actually assumed a meaning of its own. If you go to urbandictionary.com, which is a website which I recommend, even though it's full of stupidity and ugliness, but because anybody can define any word that he or she wants to and send it in, and it will be printed unless it's just too foul. And then everybody who goes on to that site can vote up or down. So you have this thumb down for, and so there, you know, it's not like Wikipedia where everybody rewrites everything along the way. There are all these definitions that are you can't say in print, can you? You can say that are there to be read. And as it happens, the most coherent definitions, I would gather from looking at them quite a bit, rise to the top. It's kind of heartening, and it causes people to vote more up than down. And the word thee, and if you have children and they use words that you don't understand, and you're sure you want to understand them, you might go on Urban Dictionary, because a lot of young people go there and define words that aren't in the dictionary. The word thee has been, as I say, has been mistyped so many times that the word te has a meaning of its own. According to Urban Dictionary, te means sort of an intensified thee. I'm not familiar with it. It says, as in capital E-L is used in Spanish, like, I don't know, El taco, which apparently means some taco or something, I don't know. So te has taken on, you know, I had te milkshake the other day. Means you can't say I had the milkshake, but you can say te because it means some resounding sort of wonderful milkshake, apparently. And if you go to the word the on UrbanDictionary.com, the number one dictionary, the number one definition, the most popular approved definition by the most thumbs is that the is the most common misspelling of the word te. You know, I try not to think fondly of texting words, but every now and then. And then the word ite, you know, that people use not only in speech but in writing, A-I-G-H-T. I find sort of pleasing, too. It probably should have an apostrophe after the A, but that would be a bit fussy, I think. I like aight. Aight. I was talking about thee because I had an experience once involving the word thee, in which the word thee loomed large. I was writing I was commissioned by Sports Illustrated to write a story with Wilt Chamberlain. As told to me, by Wilt Chamberlain, as told to me. And so I went to his mansion in Bel Air, near here, up in the hills. It was a big place. The ceiling was a little taller than this because Wilt was a tall person. He was a great basketball player, and he was about 7'1", supposedly, but I think he was much bigger than that. And so he had a tall ceilings. He also had a decorative feature in his house that I have not seen in anybody else's house, which was wolf muzzles. You know, the fur from the muzzle of wolves, not the nose part, just the fur. Many wolf muzzle furs sewn together. I suppose his decorator came upon somehow or another a truckload of wolf muzzles. I didn't want to inquire into the provenance, but he had wolf muzzle upholstery and wolf muzzle carpeting, and it tended to, give the place a certain tone somehow or another. But we worked together really well. Not every athlete has been very literary. Pete Rose, for instance, somebody once asked him if he had ever read, how many books he had ever read. And he gave that question serious thought and said, I don't think I've ever read a book. And somebody said, but Pete, you've written too. But Wilt was not like that. Wilt Chamberlain was not only well-spoken, but lots of people who are eloquent orally, or when you write down what they said, it doesn't really hold together that well. But Wilt, you know, it was all sort of grammatical and made sense. And I just had to fiddle with it a little bit as the just sort of edited it a little bit and, you know, arranged the chunks and stuff, and it worked out fine. So, but we were in his house. The problem was that Wilt had done a story with me with Sports Illustrated before like this, and he felt that he had been misrepresented by the headline. So his deal with Sports Illustrated was that he got to approve every word, not only in the text, but in the headline. So we were waiting there for the headlines to come back from New York. In those days, we didn't have faxes or laptops. We had a thing, a big clunky machine called, which Hunter Thompson called what do you call it, Kirby?
Mojo machine.
Mojo machine. I can't think tonight. He called it a mojo machine. And you would transmit a piece of typed copy through this big clunky thing, which hooked into a phone, and it would gradually convey it from phone to phone. Now, as I say, Wilt had felt misrepresented in the past, and he was there. You know, one thing about Wilt, one aspect of his prodigiousness was that in his memoir, he reported that he had slept with 20,000 women. I know the editor of that book, and after the thing came in there, he was looking at it, and he called Wilt up, and he said, "Wilt, we're doing the math here." And but Wilt said, "Well, okay, yeah, I know it seems like a lot, but there was this one big birthday party, principally." So what's really impressive to me is that anybody who can break up with 20,000 women, it seems to me really impressive. But at any rate, but there weren't any women around, but there were lots of large men. They weren't as big as Wilt was, but they were big enough to be his friends, and they were there to protect him from me, essentially. And they were kind of just sort of pacing around, you know, we were waiting for the headlines to come in. And the main headline, the lead headline came up, and it said, I handed it up to Wilt, and he looked at it, and it said, quote, "My impact will be everlasting." And that was fine with him. It was commensurate with his stature, and he had said it, and fine. But then the subhead came in, and I was looking at it. It said, "A dominant force in basketball announces his retirement from the game." And I was afraid that wasn't going to work, but I passed it up to Wilt, and he looked at it and said, "A dominant force?" And I said, "Well, you know, I think the operative terms there are dominant. I mean, he was certainly dominant and force." And he said, "A dominant force?" And at that, his friends started moving around saying things like, "A dominant? He wasn't A dominant. Where'd you get A dominant? Man, dominant. What are you A dominant about it?" And I said, "You would perhaps prefer the dominant." And he said that he would. But I could see that "the" was not going to fit on the headline. And there were some other dominant forces around in basketball. So I said, "Well, we'll have to call back to New York." And so I called on the phone to get the editor. Unfortunately, you know, it was 3 hours later in New York there, and the editor was not in his office. But fortunately, we had a miraculous telephone operator there named Muriel, who could just find anybody somehow or another and patch them into the conversation. And she knew how good she was, and therefore she did not take any guff from anyone. We had this imperious French managing editor named André Laguerre, who was this legendary person who had been de Gaulle's press officer in World War II. And he once hung his phone up loudly, and it rang immediately again, and his secretary picked it up and said, "André, it's Muriel." And André got on, and it was Muriel. And Muriel said, "Andre, if everyone in the building whanged his receiver, I would have to have brain surgery." So André never whanged his receiver again, so far as I know. At any rate, Muriel found the editor, but unfortunately she found him where I was afraid she would find him, which was in a Chinese restaurant called the Ho-Ho. The Ho-Ho had two virtues. One was that it was very, very close to the offices of Sports Illustrated, and the other was that every fourth drink was free, which meant that it didn't hardly pay, when you think about it, not to have eight. And the editor was into about his sixth or seventh when I reached him, and I said, "I'm here with Wilt, and he doesn't like A dominant. He wants it to be the dominant." And the editor responded in a way that was all the more frustrating because it sounded sort of like human speech, but saying dominant, I don't know, me, I don't know, and he'd wander off and talk to somebody else, and every now and then a waiter would come on and say, who you want? And I said, no. And the guys, Wilt's friends, were wandering around saying things like, thing I don't see is you come into a man's home and call him a dominant. I was sitting there on the, and the wolf muzzles were bristling up under me on the couch. I finally said, Wilt, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to talk to him yourself. So I passed the phone up to Wilt, and Wilt said, yes, Wilt Chamberlain here. No, I understand. I know perfectly well the meaning of the word dominant. I know the word force. That's not the issue. Well, I know it's a small, well, but I realize I'm a, yeah, but, well, I know, but, and, all right. And he, to my astonishment, I was hearing Wilt mollified, and I took the phone back from him, and he looked down at me and said, who the hell is Muriel? So there's a question that, and at this point in the evening, I thought perhaps you might have some questions about what we have covered so far. Yes, sir. They're going to bring you a microphone.
Oh, right behind you. Here you go.
Bring you a mic.
Yes.
M-I-K-E.
Yes.
Mic.
I had two questions listening to you. First, your pronunciation of Google. Do you say alcohol?
Alcohol? Alcohol? Uh-huh. No. But you mean the original Google. Google.
The original Google, when I was a kid, we always said Google.
Google.
Like alcohol. And the other question I was wondering about was, when you started out, you used an adjective for an adverb. What do you think of people who do that?
I used an adjective for an adverb?
Yes.
Which one was that?
Well, at my age, I can't remember, right? But I did remember.
Sure, it was me.
I did remember that, but it is a common occurrence, and a lot of people are upset by it, and I just wondered what your opinion was.
Well, it's a little hard for me to go back myself and remember what.
No, I mean just using in speech.
Well, give me an example of somebody using an adjective.
Well, like bad for badly or something like that.
Oh, well, it depends. If you say, you're not supposed to say I feel badly. You're supposed to say I feel bad because that isn't bad is an adverb in that case.
Right.
You know, I feel badly means I don't have very good sense in my fingers.
Right. But if you use them incorrectly.
You say you're doing bad, in other words, is wrong.
Yes.
I don't know what I said, but I think sometimes that words that are supposed to be ungrammatical are better than words that are. I mean, like ain't. Ain't is not supposed to be correct, but it was in the 18th century, and it was just fussy 19th century ones who decided it was bad. But it has a lot. Ain't seems to me to have a lot better tang. And there is no other contraction of am not. If it weren't for ain't, you'd have to say amnant. You'd have to sing, in fact, amnant misbehaving. So I don't know. Or isn't she sweet, which sounds just sort of prissy to me. Whereas ain't she sweet sounds pretty good. So I don't know. I wish I could remember what I did wrong. I would confess it if I knew what it was. They'll bring you a mic, M-I-K-E, mic.
I have two questions. One, do you still have your band with Dave Barry? And my second question is, what do you think the derivation is of the word copacetic?
Copacetic. The band that I am associated with, Rock Bottom Remainders, does in fact still exist. It's it's authors, Dave Barry and Stephen King and Ridley Pearson and Amy Tan and lots of Scott Rowe, lots of Mitch Albom, lots of wonderful writers, all of whom sell more books than I do. So it's really humbling. I'm also the least. James McBride is in the band. James McBride can actually play the saxophone. And really, Pearson started out being a musician before he became a writer. And I introduced the band and wander around behind them doing some eccentric dancing, which is... And also come in on wow thing, you know, when you move me, you know, that passage there, that's you move me, I come in on that. I don't usually come in at exactly the right time, but I come in close enough, you know. We're going to, in fact, this weekend, we're flying from here to Miami, and the band will be appearing in Miami, still alive, and it started out as sort of a joke, and people keep wanting us to do it some more. And we've had people, Bruce Springsteen sang with us once. I was there on stage. I don't think he noticed that I was there, but we were singing Gloria. I sing titles pretty much, you know, G-L-O-R-I-A, Gloria. I sing things like that. Copacetic. I believe that Copacetic's derivation is obscure. I've looked it up a number of times, and there are various theories, but I don't think any one of them has been confirmed. I can't think what they are. But do you have a theory of what it comes from? Yeah. What?
I think it's from the Hebrew kol beseder, which means everything is okay. Huh. And that's what copacetic is usually, that's the way it's usually reused. I think it's from all the Jewish kids who went to summer camp and then came into the entertainment industry, and they say to each other copacetic, and it just caught on. Because They really meant kol beseder and were mispronouncing it.
I'm happy with that origin, but I think there are different theories. I've read, there's a great book called Born to Kvetch, I think it is, which is all about Yiddish. And the word Kvetch is very interesting and very, I won't talk about it on television because its origin is very physical. And there should be more words in English that start with KV, I think. Yes, here's one.
Do you know when the Proto-Indo-European people lived, people that use that language?
I don't, you heard the question, do I know where Proto, I don't think it's, where they went? No. When? No, I don't know. But it would have been back before, much before, say, 800, which the year 800, which is when most English, that's when things, we start hearing, when English words start being found, you know, as early as English words, old English gets dated as like 800 AD. So I don't know, but I don't think, as far as I know, nobody knows. But they were back there, and it would be great if we could go back and talk to them. But I don't know. Anybody else? Yeah.
I'm wondering if you would agree that regional accents can affect the meaning of words. I'm reminded because my wife is from Greasy Corner, Arkansas, and her pronunciation of the word P-I-E is similar to yours.
Right.
And it seems to me that a Yankee P-I-E is kind of a thin piece of apple pie, but a Southern pie has more grease and sugar and whipped cream and so on.
Well, I think you're right, yes. Sometimes I get my back up when people raise the issue of accents and the physicality of words, because I'm afraid they're going to be indulging in what I call an ad hominy argument, which is the only reason I think these things is because I have eaten too many grits. But I think pie is a particularly poignant example of how you can, to me, pie, if you've ever heard Bessie Smith sing I love that man like a schoolboy love his pie, she doesn't say pie. And I think people think that Southern accents are strange and forced and put on in part because so much of rootsy music is sung by people who aren't Southern, but sung in a Southern accent because it goes better that way. Pie. I just like pie better than pie. And on. You know the story about people who went to, northern white people went to a civil rights rally and hollered, right arm, because, wrong arm, excuse me, right arm, because they didn't say on for O-N, they said on for O-N. To me, on is better, but on is certainly highly defensible on spelling ground, on grounds of spelling. Yeah, anybody else? Yeah. Wait till you get your M-I-K-E mic.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Have you noticed that certain past tenses of irregular verbs are disappearing, like sing, sang, sung? People are going straight to sung.
Yeah.
They don't say, I sang the song, they say, I sung it.
I sung the song, yeah.
And the other thing is, there's a book about Proto-Indo-European you might want to read called The Horse, the Wheel, and Language, but I don't remember the author. But he's got a nice new theory about where and when it came from.
Oh, good. Did you have an answer for the man who wanted to know when?
If he reads the book, he'll find out.
Yeah, go to that book. Yeah. There are two people together, a joint question.
One of the reasons that we came here was because we are avid listeners of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Avid, okay. Just wondering, how do you and the other panelists get started on something like that?
Is that your brother, and does he approve this question? Okay.
Yes, he does.
The question is, how do we, on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, how do we get started on...
How did you get the idea to go on there? Was it your own idea, or did Peter Sagal ask you to go on?
Did Carl?
Carl, yeah. I'll tell you that Doug Berman, who created the show, told me that he started. I don't know any of you ever watched the old quiz program with quiz show hosted by Groucho Marx called "You Bet Your Life." The straight guy on that was Fenneman. Remember, George Fenneman was the guy. The duck comes down, you win $100. Doug Berman, who created the show, said he started with Carl as Fenneman and worked out from there. Carl is the rock on which the show is built. But it started out with a different host. Peter was not the original host. I don't know why. I was on the first panel. Consisted of Peter and Roxanne Roberts and me. I almost said I. We had this other host whose name I don't even remember. He didn't seem to be into the show that much. You would say something, it was sort of like trying to bounce a mud ball off of a wall instead of a rubber ball. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Then they got Peter to come move to Chicago from New York to be the host, and then things started coming together. But I don't know how they picked the panelists. But I know when I was a kid, I used to watch What's My Line, which, I always wanted to be on a What's My Line sort of show, and so I'm glad to be on this one. It has evolved over the years. It's much better now than it started out. And it used to be done, everybody was in separate studios and all over everywhere. I did it out of my house. They gave me some earphones and a special line. Unfortunately, where I live in Western Massachusetts, the phone lines are so antiquated that I was on a slight delay. So I would have to start talking before I knew what I was going to say in order to get a word in edgewise. Okay, two more questions. Okay, the same family. Now he's going to hog the entire... Okay, well, I'll come back.
I got it, I might as well say. I apologize for coughing during your talk, but I wanted to ask if you've discovered any interesting new words during this recent campaign season. There's all kinds of things that pop up during the course of campaigns.
Palin is an... The interesting new conjunction that Sarah Palin uses, which is the word there. Whenever she loses track of what she's saying, I think she tosses in a T-H-E-R-E, there, you know, and then goes off on some other tack in the same sentence. It's very remarkable. I'm sure, I can't think of, let me go back, I'm sorry, who do we have over here? Yeah.
I have two questions. One is usage. Is it, which is correct? None of these is correct. None of these are correct. That's one question. The other question is, which malapropisms of our current president will you miss?
The first question is between none is or none are. Neither of those is correct. No, I'm sorry. It depends. I mean, I was taught none of these is because no one is. But the British don't believe that, and lots of people I know. I think it's sort of, I don't think you should be too sticky about that because a lot of people, none is sort of strictly correct, I guess, but none are often sounds, makes more sense somewhere or another. So I think we can not be too strict about that one. And as far as the malapropisms of George Bush, I won't miss any of them. But, that's not for me, is it? That's for, no. Was there one other over here? I'm sorry. Huh? Okay, good. Thank you very much, and appreciate it.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.